This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. Matt Patrick. Patrick, you've been around. How long have you been here at the station with us here?
I have been here almost a year and a half.
A year and a half. You were here when I want to bring up just really quick at the beginning. The Star Tribune, congratulations to them. They won the Pulitzers for the coverage of George Floyd, the death of George Floyd at the hands of Derek Chauvin, and, of course, the uprising afterwards. I'm a little surprised that not a major point of this story is. Do you remember those shows that I did on the Tuesday? It would be the Wednesday show, then the shows the next Monday after not only we had the Bob Kroll, Paul Gazelka attempted usurping of the governor, but then on top of that, you had the allegedly, but then you had more targeting of the media on that Friday and Saturday night of the uprising that happened in Minneapolis. Do you remember how angry I was? I mean, I was angry about a lot of things.
That might have been before I became the regular weekday guy.
I was livid. I want to give credit to the folks over at the Star Tribune and pretty much all media. They were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for breaking news, reporting the coverage of killing George Floyd. They paid for that with the blood of targeted journalists that was spilled in the pursuit of that news coverage. This wasn't some war-torn country in Central America or Africa or Asia. This was in our city where the Minneapolis Police Department, for some in-freaking inexcusable reason, in their frustration that their little secrets were getting out, went after the media, and not just the Star Tribune, Unicorn Riot, CNN, numerous other media outlets were attacked, attacking clearly marked press and media out of joy and giggles. And I was livid then. I'm still livid. I remember the picture. It was at Andy Mannix from the Star Tribune, the wound he had in his leg, the one woman that lost an eye. A lot of people were injured. Media was injured just trying to do their job. They earned this. That blood earned that for the Star Tribune. And that should be, in my mind, the top of the page, above the fold. Thank you, journalists. Thank you, workers, for going into a freaking war zone and being attacked and targeted for just doing your job. Nicely done, the journalists of the Star Tribune. I don't congratulate you a lot, and for God's sakes, you got to clean up your editorial pages. Yee. But that was good coverage, and those poor journalists earned every award they're going to get. And, that was I'm still just livid at the doubling down, the absolute jerkishness of the people involved are there. So 952-946-6205. I will give you, how about we give you some good news, Patrick, to start off your day. It's official. It's official. The Minnesota State Fair is going ahead. Board of Managers gave the green light for the 2021 fair beginning August 26th through Labor Day, September 6th. After a year's hiatus due to COVID-19, you and I, pronto pup stand. Who takes them down more? I've got smart money on Matt McNeil.
I put the money on you, too. I was telling some people today that the exhale they heard across America with the 6 million Minnesotans
getting to go to the fair.
Who can't wait to go to the fair again.
Well, what food do you want to get into a food eating competition with me on?
I'll do the cheese on a stick, the corn on a cob.
Oh, my God. Okay, we could do the corn. Which stand? Which one are we talking about? Is the one over by the carousel? Right by the grandstand?
Yeah, that one.
Oh, okay. Next to the Gator guy.
Yeah, the gator legs.
And Fox 9 and Alex and Tom over there. I always stop by and see those guys because I used to do traffic with them years ago. I always stop by and say hi to them when they're there. But a corn-eating contest, that's going to go wrong in a lot of ways. Do you like walleye? Have you done the walleye sandwich in the food booth?
I've never tried that.
You like walleye?
No.
Okay. Gyro stand. There's a gyro stand right next to on the other side of the Fox 9 booth. That's got the best gyros. I love the gyros there. You want to do that one?
Yeah, let's do that one.
Man, I bet I could take down six. You see, all this health crisis, you know, I went to the hospital. I've gone through this. I'm going to get all better. Come September 7th, back in. I shouldn't have gone to the fair. Darn you, pronto pup stand. The approved and provided nothing serious shifts in Minnesota. Between now and the 26th, the state fair will go ahead without any significant restrictions, meaning there'll be no capacity limits. Proof of vaccination won't be required for guests, staff, or vendors, nor will face masks be mandatory, although the Minnesota State Fair will still urge those who have not been vaccinated to wear them. Unfortunately, the people that have not been vaccinated are the people that are like, you're violating my freedoms by requiring me to wear this. Who convince themselves a minor inconvenience is somehow something that was installed in the Constitution, which it wasn't. The state fair does say it will adhere to federal and state guidelines on terms of cleaning and sanitation measures. Yeah, first time for everything. Sorry, state fair. Sorry. I recant that. I'll take that back. While anyone who has tested positive for COVID-19 within 14 days visit is told not to attend. And yeah, I'm going to just say this. I wouldn't be surprised if you tried that and we found out. I don't think people would be too happy with you. There'll be changes in terms of the activities available due to COVID-19. Other optional challenges with attractions, including Third Lair Skate Park, Equimania, the Festival of Nations Demonstration Stage, Giant Sing-Along, Go-Karts, Laser Encores, Laser Hit Show. I think they need another laser in that name. Laser Encores, Laser Hit, Laser Show. And the River Raft Ride canceled. They're all canceled. So much for the lasers. Because nothing in this day and age gives people more comfort than being in large crowds with laser pointers being pointed at them. So, well, State Fair's on, so I think we all can feel a little bit more comfortable, a little bit happier, and, yeah, feel a little bit better about how things are going. So, yay. I'm feeling okay with that.
Yeah, did I hear the Space Tower is going to be open, though? You're putting a bunch of people in a round cylinder object.
What's the thing that's on the Midway that they put in and they spin you around and it's the Vomit Comet? What is that thing? Do you know what I'm talking about? It's a kind of an upside-down rhombus.
Yeah. I can't think of it.
Right by the fry stands. Good thinking, everybody. Trying to think about... That would be far more dangerous than me. Or that one ride that's on the Midway at the very end where you lay down flat and it kind of flips you around and all this stuff. I don't want to be in the splash zone there. I mean, I don't need the R-rated Gallagher concert breaking out. Ugh.
I thought Magnum was the one that would make people make them have to go get more food when they're done.
It's always, well, it's actually after a lap. You always feel bad. And then all of a sudden you're like, what do I smell now? I'm a big fan of the zipper. Oh, I love the zipper. That's a great ride. And of course, right then next to it, animal barns, because nothing says cleanliness and safetiness than the smell of livestock. 952-946-6205. Okay, so yesterday we broke down a little bit about a story that came out about Derek Chauvin. It was a Daily Beast story that said he had a house in Florida. And in Windermere, Florida, which, as I had multiple people actually mention to me yesterday, Windermere is a high-end community. I mean, that's not cheap. But his house apparently was around $300,000 down there. Which is about the median house price in Minneapolis, St. Paul. He owned at one point a house in St. Paul. And I just sort of said, how did this guy afford two houses, especially one in what could be described as a fairly well-to-do, wealthy Orlando community? on a cop salary, a Minneapolis cop salary. And a lot of people came in, oh, man, overtime, stuff like this. I'm saying, okay, fine. But when we factored in and someone sent me the information, and I'm not sure, I can't confirm necessary. You know, someone sent me it, someone I trust. I still can't confirm it. But if the numbers they sent me are true, we're looking at $600,000 plus worth of property with taxes and all that stuff afterwards, $700,000. $700,000 on a cop salary for houses? And that's just for houses. You need to be making your annual salary at that point somewhere around $230,000, $240,000. You're getting that much overtime? I can't believe that. But, you know, we said yesterday, we don't know the details. We don't know. Thanks, Mom and Dad. They gave him a gift. We don't know. And we did find out, we actually had Dynamo Dave call up and wonder about auctions, but apparently someone clarified that a police officer in Florida cannot have early advance options on a auctioned house or anything like that. So that was off the table. But, I mean, that was a good point, Dave. So thank you very much for that. But, you know, there seems to be some question. I mean, I at the very least, is it really that odd to say maybe someone should look into the financials of the guy who murdered someone in the streets in Minneapolis and see if he was really a upstanding individual when it came to his taxes? But there is something else that bothered me about this. And a few years ago, there was some stories that were out in regards to snowbirds. Now, what you get with snowbirds are people that buy houses. They live in Minneapolis, in Minnesota. I mean, they live in Minnesota for the majority of the year. They buy a house for 3, 4, maybe 5 months, usually 3 or 4, though, in some other part of the country, usually Arizona, Florida, or Texas. And what they've tried to do in this, I can't remember the story. This was years ago. I'm talking maybe like 8 years ago. I remember this story where there was some talk going on at the Capitol about rewriting the snowbird rules because Republicans wanted to say, well, if you live one day in Florida, you shouldn't have to pay Minnesota taxes and that sort of thing. I mean, just basically right in the pocket of these guys. And I'm paraphrasing, but you kind of get the idea of what that story was about. And they were talking about how there was an insane amount of people that were violating the snowbird rules because Minnesota is very specific. And I want to read for you. This is from 2018. I think these are the updated rules here. And it's talking about how if you want to claim that you're not from Minnesota, that you have to claim that you want to claim that you live in Florida to not pay Minnesota taxes and say, I'm a resident of Florida. There are some pretty heavy hurdles you have to hit that you can't just say, oh, I'm living in Florida. You have to prove this. Most importantly, spend as much time as possible in your new state and as little time as possible in Minnesota. And once again, this is from a law page which seems to be geared towards trying to help people to avoid paying taxes in Minnesota and how to get past the snowbird rules. Going back to the article, generally speaking, any individual who is physically present in Minnesota for more than 183 days, okay, out of the year is by default a Minnesota resident, which is basically half the year. If you spend half the year in Minnesota, you can't claim to be someone in Florida, all right, or Arizona or Texas. Keep a very good documentation of all the days you are at your new home state, what days you're traveling, both work and personal time, what days you spend in Minnesota. You should have a travel journal log to keep track of where you are and organize receipts. So basically, the threshold is 183 days. That if I am 183 or more days in Minnesota, I am a resident of Minnesota. But if you technically can prove that you resided in Florida for half the year, well, the state of Minnesota recognizes that you live in Florida or if you live in Texas or if you live in Arizona. See how that works. Okay. But there's multiple other rules here that have to be followed and that will be factored in that the state of Minnesota looks at. The location of your domicile for prior years. So if you lived in St. Paul, per se, or a suburb of St. Paul, and you lived there for many years, and all of a sudden that you change, they're going to look more intently at your change. Where the person votes or is registered to vote. Now, that's a big deal. So if, you know, and in the case, I'll pull a hypothetical case. Say you have a guy who is trying to run away from the state of Minnesota and is in Florida hiding, okay? And, you know, was here for sure pretty close to half a year, but then was down there. If they voted in Minnesota, that's an acknowledgement by themselves that they're a resident of Minnesota. You see how that works? Okay. Just a hypothetical. Just pulling. You know, it makes sense. status as a student, classification of employment as temporary or permanent, location of employment. Once again, just a hypothetical. Say you were a fireman for the city of Minneapolis. One would expect that you would be residing in Minneapolis and not commuting via Florida every day to your job. I mean, just, you know what I mean? And just hypothetical. You just kind of put that out there. Location of newly acquired living quarters, other owned and rented. So if you're renting something else in that one community. Present status of the former living quarters, whether it was sold, offered for sale. Now, we do know that Chauvin did sell his property. Let's see here if I've got that. He sold it on 9-3, September 3rd, which if you go from January 1st to 9-3, that's 251 days, okay? Now, I tried to figure out, I went and looked through news stories to try to figure out what day I could peg Derek Chauvin as being in Minnesota for sure. The 25th of May is when he murdered George Floyd. It seems like he was in town for at least 2 to 3 weeks, but where he was afterwards, and that's actually a plays a role because up until June 1st, January 1st to June 1st, that's only 151 days. So that gives him basically 32 more days to work with. But I got to believe because of all the court cases and all the stuff that he had to have been, I don't know how the thing works there, but that's something I'm keeping an eye on here. Okay. Whether homestead status has been questioned or obtained for property tax purposes, new purchase living owner. So basically, if he used his property to as a lien against other properties, ownership of other real property, jurisdiction where the valid driver's license was issued. That's a big one because that I know that the state has gone and said, well, where is your driver's license? So unless you get down there and change your driver's license immediately, that you can come that the driver's license being issued from Minnesota can come back and bite you. Jurisdiction from which any professional licenses were issued. So, did you change your professional license? Your professional license, for Minneapolis police, must have been from Minneapolis. So, that's going to be there. When did you rescind that? Location of person's union membership. Now, that one has a little teeth. Because, let's remember, through the police union, he got his representation, which means the police union is recognizing him as a Minneapolis cop through his entire trial, which goes into this year, which would make when he moved down there moot. Jurisdiction when every motor vehicle license was issued, either residence, and you get the point. There are multiple things that could be there. And so as I'm looking through this, and I want to be very clear. I have no idea if he has paid his taxes. I have no idea this. It's just one of those stories like when I hear a police officer affording $700,000 worth of property, a murderer, former cop, murderer affording $700,000 worth of property on a Minneapolis Police Department salary, factoring in his wife might be making some money as well, but it's still a lot of money. That raises a red flag, and I just ask the question, should we look into his finances? When I run through this and I see this, the question I said is, well, going back to that story from about 8 years ago, was he paying his taxes or did he try to play that he wasn't a Minnesota resident and he actually doesn't have to pay taxes in Minnesota, whatever the case may be? I just think that it's worth a look. And that would be an easy seat. I mean, he clearly prior to last year was a resident of Minneapolis or a resident of Minnesota, I should say, resident of Minnesota. So maybe someone should look in and see if the murderer paid his taxes. Because you know what? Heap it up. Make the biggest frickin' Sunday you can. You got some more violations? Pile them on. I don't care. My pity and sorrow for that piece of human scum does not exist. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Once again, a clarification. I don't know if anything's wrong. I just think it's worth a look. We'll take a break. Come on back. The stupidity of Republicans when I do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show, 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I want to bring up Minnesota Reformer has a good story here. By the way, I got to mention, next hour, jam-packed. Got Brett's in here with Ryan Winkler, majority leader in the House. He's going to join him, talk about the negotiations. Great interview setting up for that. He's recording it right now. They're working on that right now. And also, John Crippen is going to join us, the executive director of the Hennepin History Museum. He wants to talk a little bit about history, because you want to know the truth is, history is ugly. That's what history is. It's that you shouldn't try to candy coat it. You shouldn't try to, you know, only look at certain parts of it. You should look at all history. And you be prepared for the fact that history is ugly, and that there's a lot that you have to accept. But you don't make yourself better unless you look at and realize the mistakes we've made. 952-946-6205. Back to the Minnesota Reformer story. Minnesota Republicans and school choice advocates gathered at the Capitol on Thursday to urge Governor Walz to meet with them about Senate school voucher proposal. The advocates want Walz and Democratic farm labor leaders to back a program called Education Savings Account. McNeil, how dare you besmirch me with this conversation? Oh, God, it's a Dyna guy. You people with your public schools, how dare you? What we as a society need, we need you to go on out and allow us to take taxpayer dollars and pay for my little Richie Richie's big private school.
Oh, Edina guy, that doesn't make any sense, because it says here the Republicans, they're saying it's got to make you have to be less than like $150,000 a year in salary.
Pierce Posh, you mean those pawns that we dangle at the end of our keychain? Yes, the Minnesota GOP. They're delightful when I want a beverage. Anywho, here's the deal. If you talk to any tax preparer and you are a wealthy person like me, you know, millions and millions of dollars, let me tell you something, that it's really easy if you file your taxes separately, that my wife, Bathilda, I love her so much. She claims an income of $75,000 a year. Now, my income is millions of dollars. But hers is only $75,000. And so what we do is we enroll in the program through her altered, separate tax filing. And so she falls under that mythical 150,000 number. And so we get you heathen people, you rapscallions in these public schools, paying our child, our brilliant child, our leader of the future, oh, little Richie Rich. We get you paying for our child's private education. They're delightful.
And scene. Oh, sorry. I have no idea why I just did that, but you get my point, okay? They want to push the voucher program, and there have the states that have put this in here. The secret's out. The Republicans say, hey, we're only doing this for the needy people. Bull crap. No, it's not. They set a number here, and what's the number that they – that who did we get here? We got Chamberlain and Benson. Ugh. The program would be open to first-come, first-served basis for families earning up to three times the income limit for reduced-price lunch, or about $150,000 for a family of four. But if you, there are rules that say that if you file your taxes separately, and wealthy people do this a lot, so that one of the parents is basically looking like, I'm poor. So they qualify for a program like this. Guess what? In a lot of states, they have actually tracked it to where these vouchers go to the extremely wealthy families, so that taxpayers in the poorest communities are paying for the private school tuition of wealthy people. It's absolute garbage. It is. And, of course, the Republicans will always go on out there and find a handful of needy people, a lot of times minorities, who do need help, because the schools have been horribly misfunded. They don't offer the programs that they have. They have a lot of things that want to get into a private school and use them as props, because those kids don't represent the vast majority of the kids who will get that benefit. And don't ever forget this. Vouchers are garbage. But this even gets better, because this is such a bad idea that it makes me actually question whether Chamberlain,
It's under the Republican Chamberlain or the Republican Benson or any Republican. Did you guys actually take math in school? I'll get to my point here, okay? I'll get to my point here. Basically, what they want to do is the advocates want walls and Democratic farm laborers to back a program called Education Savings Minnesota as part of a Senate education budget proposal. The Department of Education, the teachers union, Democrats oppose the idea. Well, we take money from local school districts and give it to families to pay for private school tuition and supplies. Now, and the other another ugly secret here. This is by no means meant for all kids in these school districts. It's meant for a handful of kids, a lot of time the kids that can play sports, and they basically get them into private schools. Don't fool yourself. This is not a program for the masses. This is a program for a select few. Roger Chamberlain, Republican from Island Lakes, Michelle Benson from Ham Lake. Once again, two people I have to question whether they have math in their background. And a group of parents from the Capitol spoke for who are heading into Crash Walls' news conference. Go up there, Chamberlain said, pointing to the Capitol as he addressed the parents. Do what you need to do and go up and ask Walls why parents can't have the opportunity. Why won't we meet them right there with Governor Walls? So he goes up there. And by the way, Chamberlain, you absolute moron. Have you seen what's been going on with right-wing groups in this country when they go up to try to take on people? You sending them up there to go get them. Well, how stupid are you, Chamberlain? Apparently, really. Anyway, the education savings accounts are a sticking point in education budgets. Chamberlain's latest proposal includes a 3% increase in the per pupil funding formula, a complicated equation that sets minimum funding. The 3% increase is greater than those included, but it also includes these vouchers the DFL lawmakers say are out of the question. Experts say there's little evidence linking voucher-style programs to academic gains, which is true. They've actually had multiple studies that show that most of the time all this does is filter certain kids to private schools with no real benefit to the masses. Low-income students are often left out of education savings account programs together. Under Chamberlain's education savings account, 1% of the Minnesota student body, or about 8,600 students, would be eligible for this program. 8,600 students. I want to repeat that because this is a number. Republicans, once again, don't seem to be too keen on numbers. 8,600. That would be their initial qualifying goal. That's their biggest priority. This is the biggest education priority for the Republicans. 8,000 total kids. 1% of the entire public school population of the state. They basically went up there and confronted Walls. It's a non-starter, and that's the deal. Now, why do I say I bring up I brought up the numbers here, and said that not only is it fraudulent on the tax numbers about the 150 because you can file separately and a wealthy person's spouse can kind of get under that number and they can take advantage of this program. So there's garbage like that. It's not meant for everyone, and you'll get to that in just a moment. But it's the priority that the Republican Party of Minnesota is going to derail the entire education bill for 8,600 students, ignoring what happened earlier this week when most of Minneapolis and all of St. Paul had to shut down their schools because those kids were in an educational environment where it was a freaking sauna and the school just said, we're done. Now, the city of St. Paul has a total of 38,380 kids in their public school system, all of which stopped because the heat was so bad, the buildings they're being educated in are so substandard that they cannot get a quality education if it gets above 80 degrees. In Minneapolis, the total number is 36,370 kids, but not all schools closed. But still, you are looking at well over 50,000, if not near 60,000 kids in Minneapolis and St. Paul alone that were sent home because it was too hot, that the schools were incompatible with humane treatment of children for education. 50,000. Not including numerous outstate and rural schools who have the same problem. Inferior buildings, not enough air conditioning. They just sent the kids home. 50,000 who can't even learn in their classroom because the classroom is substandard. And the Republican Party's only concern is 8,000 kids in a private voucher program. You know what the failure of our education system is? To teach the Republican Party of Minnesota basic math. Your number one priority should be, I don't know, making sure the total of 75,000 kids in the Minneapolis-St. Paul Public School actually have a safe and welcoming learning environment, which is not a sauna at the YMCA. Instead, you guys are focused on this dog and frickin' pony show where 8,000 kids, mostly wealthy white kids or athletes or a handful of token people that you use to push your agenda, are given a voucher just so you can basically go after the teachers' union. The heck with that. You guys are morons. You need to go back to school because you know what? You just failed. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. Minnesota Coronavirus Update when I do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. We might not have hit 90 today. When it got those clouds came through, cooled down enough. We got to 89, but now we're down to 88. We might have finally broke those 90s, but yeah, 89 is not exactly, ooh, let me grab my scarf. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Minnesota coronavirus update. Governor Tim Walz thanks Minnesotans on Friday for driving COVID-19 numbers down to the levels not seen since March of 2020. Encouraged unvaccinated people to get their free shots and vaccinated people 21 and older to pick up a free or discounted drink on a reward. Vice. You can always go with Vice, you know. The governor spoke at LaDonna Civarecha, Minneapolis, on Friday, is one of the at least 16 microbreweries or distilleries offering rewards to people who present their vaccination cards or photos of their cards. It's those vaccines that will allow this place to be packed tonight and allow people to come back out, enjoy all the things they love so much in the summer, said Walz before buying a can of Big Mama Blonde Ale for Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan. Walz's enthusiasm came for the fifth straight day in which Minnesota reported 200 or less infections of the coronavirus that caused COVID-19. That's 177 infections. Still 12 deaths reported on Friday. Raise a drink for them, please. And Friday raised Minnesota's pandemic totals to 603,466 infections, 7,496 deaths, but reflected overall declines in the viral spread. The state reported positivity rates of diagnostic testing had dropped to 2.1%, well below the 5% caution threshold, and the number of COVID-19 patients admitted to Minnesota hospitals has declined from 699 on April 14th to 184 on Thursday. Establishments offering, there's a lot of breweries here. I'll put out a link to the Star Tribune story. They have all the you want to go get your drink on, and you got vaccinated, knock yourself out. Just one beer, unless you're a light drinker, you know, get the small ones. State Employment Economic Development Commissioner Steve Grove encouraged Minnesotans to support these establishments, which suffered financial hardships amid state-ordered closures and capacity restrictions. Absolutely. And they followed the rules. Another great reason you need to support a lot of these businesses, they didn't sit there and bellyache and try to turn everything political. They understood that we were going through a major health crisis, and for society's benefit, it was best to try to save as many human lives as possible. They weren't greedy, selfish jackasses. That's why. And they've gone through a hard time. Help them out, by all means. The establishments are bearing the cost of the Cheers to the Vaccines Reward Program. That's good. And so as much as an incentive to get vaccinated, it's actually pretty touching that people will still come here and spend their money, even though they could get a free beer, because a lot of people are still offering into it. Loon Liquors in Northfield is part of the vaccination program, is offering rum-infused cocktail called the Fauci Ouchie. All capacity caps and businesses ended on May 28th, 2 weeks after Walz lifted Minnesota's mask mandate. Walz says Mayo Clinic's models forecast the declines, which he was pleased to see those short-term predictions come true even with the removal of mitigations. However, he said he's connected with the looming threat of more infection variants in the coronavirus and some evidence that these variants are spreading more counties with low vaccination rates. And by the way, I want to make sure I say something. There's going to be a vote for extending the emergency powers. Can I make a plea? Call your DFL representative and make sure all the DFL in the House is on board with extending that, because I guarantee you right now the Republicans are working every Democrat they can to try to get enough votes to rescind it. I still trust Governor Walz. Governor Walz has gotten us through this crisis. The people who have done the most damage are the Republicans. Get to that in a second. But Governor Walz, I trust. He needs one more, in my mind, one more, maybe two more months. I think just one more month, and we'll have this under control. Give Governor Walz one more month. Call your DFL reps and tell them to extend out Governor Walz's emergency powers for one more month, okay? At least one more month. Let's see here. Nearly 3 million people 12 and older have received their first dose of COVID-19 vaccination in Minnesota. More than 2.7 million have completed the one or two dose series. The state is now on pace to fall just short of its goal, providing vaccine of 70% of people 16 and older by July 1st, sitting at a rate of 65.6 in that age group. Get vaccinated. Keep pushing, he said. We've got a little ways to go to get 70%, but again, that's somewhat just the floor. We want to keep going. State Infectious Disease Director Chris Eichmann said variant spread is occurring in some low vaccination counties, but couldn't say whether one is causing the other. Variant infections are also being found in the metro counties, which have high vaccination rates, though, she said. More than 74% of people 12 and older have received a vaccine from Hennepin County. How about that? Hennepin County, 74%. Nicely done. Todd County has Minnesota's lowest rate. 36%, less than half of the amount of people. Just, I mean, obviously, populations are different in Todd County and Hennepin County. But Hennepin County's got so many more people, and yet they're at 74%. And these boneheads up in Todd County only have 36% of the eligible people 12 and older receiving vaccines. Wait a minute here. Todd County? That's a bit of a chin stroker. Who represents Todd County? Hey, here it is. It's some guy named Gazelka. Paul Gazelka. Paul Gazelka represents Todd County, I believe. I think that's his county. And it's the worst county in the state. Oh, you remember when Paul Gazelka? Funny story. Oh, actually, not funny. Terrifying. Terrifying story. But remember when Paul Gazelka last November, in an effort to stick it to the governor and those Dems, going to get him? Sure you are, Roscoe P. Cotrain? Remember when he came on out and had a big party out in Lake Elmo with all the Minnesota GOP senators? And they pretty much cast aside any kind of restrictions and anything and just partied hardy because they won the Senate. Whip, whip. And then because they're stupid, complete, and total morons, gave themselves a super spreader event of coronavirus and likely killed one of their own senators, sickened a good chunk of the Minnesota Senate Republicans, and then did not tell the Senate DFL as they were trying to get back into session and meet with people that there was a major super spreader event. Wow, what a moron. You are stupid. Yeah, I remember that story. Anyway, is it any surprise that Todd County, where Gazelka and I should mention the House reps are Poston and Kresha? Yeah, that's a trifecta. Oh, it's like a BLT being made of bologna, lard, and taco sauce. Ugh. Those three, that's their county, and they don't even have 36% of the people in that county vaccinated. But I should a little bit about Todd County. It's 24,000. This is off of Wikipedia, so it could be wildly wrong. Let's be honest. 24,500 people live in Todd County. 1,000 Amish. Now, to give the Republicans some credit, you take those thousands off because there's a lot of people, because of their religious beliefs, that are very much against this stuff, and that's fine. You know, I don't know how the Amish are treating the vaccines. I can imagine it's per individual, congregation or church or community. So I don't know. But let's just say we'll take the 1,000 off. So that gives them 23,500 people. But still, that's 23,500 non-Amish who are just being dumb. And it presents an interesting question because this is a question we are eventually going to have to ask and is something we need to throw back at Paul Gazelka and these Republicans in counties like Todd County, where there is almost a coordinated effort to basically not get people vaccinated or downplay the importance of it or just dismiss it as no big deal. How long should the state offer assistance on this issue. And I'm you know, there's a lot of people out there, Matt, we're coming on. Don't get me wrong. I feel sorry for him. But we have got this major program. We are begging these people to get vaccinated. Begging them to get vaccinated. The state is providing the vaccination. We've got lots of incentives. We've got lots of things going on. We're trying to make it as easy as possible. Absolutely trying to make it as easy as possible to get vaccinated. So after 2 years, so say by July 4th next year, they still are only running maybe 42-43% vaccinated in Todd County, which means there's a very good chance that Todd County will become the epicenter of a coronavirus outbreak at some point in the next 5 years. Does the state keep everything open just because? Because what happens is all of a sudden things start going wrong, and then Paul Gazelka, who's scoffed at this stuff, who himself has not really taken the urgency he needs with these things, he's all of a sudden like, why isn't the state helping us? We were there for years, and you didn't take advantage of it. Is it cost-effective for taxpayers, Paul, to just keep a program open until you guys decide you want to take part in it? At what point do we just cut it loose and say, you know, well, I hope you have health insurance and I hope you're covered, because that's the way things go? I'd say 2 years. Because you know what I would guess would happen in Todd County in 2 years if all of a sudden the state was going to stop this? I'm going to guess sometime around May 1st, all of a sudden Paul Gazelka would be frantically like, we're trying to get them to extend this, but you got to get out and get vaccinated. It's going to end. You got to do it now. All of a sudden there'd be urgency. Because he knows his local community probably cannot sustain a major health outbreak and would have to come hat in hand back to the governor for help if something happened. So how long? How long do we give these counties that are basically refusing to get vaccinated the opportunity to do it on the state dime? And when do we cut them loose and say, well, good luck. Here's, you know, hope you have health care insurance. And if you want to, by all means, you can go buy a vaccine. Like I think when usual flu vaccine, depending on normal season, is like $5, $10. Some health insurance covers it completely as preventive medicine. Maybe you get lucky there. But God forbid you get sick. God forbid you die. Because I don't want anyone dead. I don't want anyone sick. And that's been my stance. That's been the stance of sanity, not the stance of the Republican Party. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Final break for the hour. When we come on back, more Minnesota coronavirus update and other things as well. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. One more update on coronavirus update here. Federal regulators have told Johnson & Johnson about the 60 million dose of its coronavirus vaccine produced by that troubled Baltimore factory cannot be used because of possible contamination, according to people familiar with the situation. The Food and Drug Administration plans to allow about 10 million doses to be distributed in the United States or sent to other countries, but with a warning that regulators cannot guarantee the Emergent BioSolutions, the company that operates the plant, followed good manufacturing practices. The agency has not yet decided whether Emergent can reopen the factory, which has been closed for nearly 2 months because of regulatory concerns. Johnson & Johnson doses administered in the United States so far were manufactured at the firm's plant in the Netherlands, not by Emergent. For weeks, the FDA has been trying to figure out what to do about at least 170 million doses of vaccine that were left in limbo after the discovery of a major production mishap involving the two vaccines manufactured at the Baltimore factory. Someone needs to go to jail for this. More than 100 million doses of Johnson & Johnson. There are certain jobs you have to have due diligence, and you can't just slap stuff against a wall and hope it sticks. And I would say making vaccines during a pandemic is one of them. More than 100 million doses of Johnson & Johnson and at least 70 million doses of AstraZeneca were put on hold after Emergent discovered in March that its workers had contaminated a batch of Johnson & Johnson vaccine with a key ingredient used to produce AstraZeneca. Federal authority officials then ordered the plant to pause production, stripped Emergent of its responsibility to produce AstraZeneca's vaccine, and instructed Johnson & Johnson to assert direct control of the manufacturing of its vaccine in there. Johnson & Johnson's vaccine is once again considered a potential game changer in the vaccine stock because it's required only one shot and was particularly useful in vulnerable communities. But the federal government now says there's an ample supply of vaccines from both Pfizer, BioNTech, BioNTech and Moderna and the two other federally authorized vaccine developers, and no longer needs Johnson & Johnson supply. Yeah. So I would say there needs to be a full investigation. What the heck happened there? Because I mean, and let's go. One thing I want to make sure I go back to is something we've been talking about the last few weeks. If this company hired people that were not actually qualified to do the job, but because they were cheap, well, the company's responsible. You have a responsibility to make sure your highly scientific product is being produced by people qualified to make a highly scientific project. And if you try to ship that out to a minimum wage job, that's shame on you. You deserve the criticism that you're going to get. By the way, one thing I just quickly on Bill Barr, the former attorney general, who clearly ordered the spying of the Justice Department on Democrats. I love today, like, who, me? What do you mean my Justice Department was actually going after Apple computers to get their things? I have no idea. Now, if you don't know the full story, Barr did bring in this guy, I think it was from Pennsylvania, to run these investigations. And I think that this was an attempt by – so Barr basically gets the – here's my suspicion. Barr gets the order from Trump to basically investigate these people because Trump was clearly a psychologically damaged, neurotic freak worse than Nixon. Barr complies but creates a – tries to create a bubble wrap around him by bringing in this guy from Pennsylvania to do the investigation so that he can be the fall guy and say, well, I – what do you mean I'm supposed to know that when we're violating major elements of our laws? I was at the salad bar. I wasn't there. Yeah. Good luck, Bill. Good luck. Hopefully we hold him accountable, but we got to depend on the Democrats there. Hour two, Ryan Winkler and John Crippen next hour. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday hour number two. Brett Johnson, kind enough to jump into studio with us. Hey, Brett.
Hey there, Matt.
Apparently, according to Sven, we broke 90 again.
Why wouldn't we?
Oh, I don't live in Houston for a reason. I need someone to swab my folds at this point. This is not good.
I like how the high of like 87 tomorrow was relief, then we're right back into the 90s next week.
But his point is that we could end up, you know, if all it takes is a little bit of sun, and next thing you know, if it goes against 90 tomorrow, we could actually break the record for consecutive 90 degrees days in Minnesota. And think about like those that 35, 38, 1935, 36. They talk about that year, like, oh yeah, you know, people are dropping like flies. It'd be worse than that.
Who wouldn't want to relive the Dust Bowl?
Oh, God, delightful. We all love the Vikings football team. No, sorry. It was an easy joke. Okay. So it's time for Brett and Matt's Business Corner. And Business Corner number one, hint of the day, do not allow family members to have access to your business's social media accounts. Story out of bringmethenews.com. A newly opened drive-through ice cream spot in Sartell is in hot water over a jobs posting that, among other things, requested no complainers, no entitlement, no race players, no binary players. Wow. Fudgin' delicious Sartell.
What are they paying, like $8 an hour to?
I'm sorry, I'm stuck on Fudgin' Delicious Sartell, because those F-U-D-G-I-N Delicious.
Wait, Sartell. Is that actually the name of it?
Fudgin'
Delicious. I thought that was something you just threw in there. That's the
actual. Because no one would. Would you ever put Fudgin' Delicious and Sartell in together in three words?
No.
That's like a safe word and a bad night of sex.
Wow.
Fudgin' Delicious Sartell. Fudgin' Delicious Sartell. I'm sorry. Okay, Fudgin' Delicious Sartell, which recently opened in the former Frugal's building, posted a job listing on Facebook on June 7th. It quickly caught the eye of some social media users who screen-grabbed and shared the now-deleted post. Here's one such on Reddit. The ad, which appeared to be posted on the account of Fudgin' Delicious owner Anna Faber, F-A-B-E-R, reads, looking for hardworking individuals, no slackers, no complainers, no entitlement, no race players, no binary players. We just want employees who want a job, want to come to work, make money, and go home. All personal thoughts and choices are not part of the jobs we're offering. Not here to hand out free paychecks, and they need to be earned. We are a fast-paced drive-through, and you must be able to put your weight onto the teams you're scheduled with. All right. So putting aside the fact, the clear political, you know, tone of this, that she's, I don't want politics here, but let me throw my politics out on the whole thing. Boy, it sounds like a delightful place to work, doesn't it?
That's just the angriest person. Why would you ever want that person as your boss?
Come on out to Gulags for delicious ice cream. Don't pay attention to the weeping workers who desperately want out of their little hut, but enjoy Gulags. Wow, that's just a bad idea.
Because it's fudge and delicious.
Fudge and delicious Sartell. The ad is lists part-time ice cream scooper and grill cooking positions with an apparent floor of $10.08 an hour.
Oh, I wasn't far off. Wow.
That's the minimum wage in Minnesota for large employees. So, boy, oh, boy. Yeah, you'll be saying fudge and delicious Sartell at that job. Social media users critical of job listings say the language used is discriminatory and ignorant. Agreed. They're urging others to consider taking their businesses elsewhere. Guess I won't be going to Fudge and Delicious anytime soon, wrote one Facebook user. Another said they'd previously gone to Fudge and Delicious, but wouldn't have to have if they'd known they were so yucky and gross to humanity. The Facebook pages for Fudge and Delicious, and you got to be careful.
There, careful.
I said it. Fudging.
Be ready back there, Patrick, on both of us.
Sartell's also a bad one. Never mind. Facebook pages for Fudge and Delicious Sartell have now been deleted, as have the pages for their locations in St. Cloud and Big Lake. Well, are you trying to hit every conservative town? But in a post on the now-defunct St. Cloud Food Court page, still visible through a cached page, the business wrote, "Our Facebook page has been hacked. There are no sales, job postings, or closures. Do not respond." Accompanying the post were two images of a screenshotted messenger conversation in which a relative of the owner who claimed to have access to the account said they published the now controversial post after mounting frustration over work happenings, including workers claiming they had their hours reduced due to race and sexual orientation. Now, first of all, you weren't hacked. You allowed someone to access and administer your site who you shouldn't have. Second of all, I think they're lying about – I think this is some white guy out in the white world who believes his Fox News, Newsmax, OAN version of reality on race and sexual orientation, and so has made up this story and said, I'm going to show those liberal hippies. And that's that. And boy, how do you do that to your family? How would you do that? I was sick and tired of hearing endless excuses as to why employees couldn't just do their job and needed to find replacements, the message in the screenshot reads. The sender also apologized to anyone who's upset about the posting and said they took full responsibility. Bring Me the News left a message with employees at Fudge and Delicious Sartell seeking a comment from the owner, but they're not allowed to touch the phone. I mean, no, I misread that. But no, they have not heard back as of publishing time. I misread that. My bad. Oops. The Sartell location is one of the three active locations for Fudge and Delicious, which really opened in Big Lake 10 years ago, Monticello Times reported. But the latest is the first to have the drive-through. In addition to ice cream, it serves other things.
I'm betting the vanilla flavor sells pretty well there.
Oh, no, yeah. Oh, I'll have a grilled cheese. I'll have a milk. And can I have a vanilla cone to go with that? And do you have any mayonnaise? But not pepper. I don't know, spicy or salt.
The milk might be a little too spicy.
Oh, yes. Is that 2%? Oh, cripes. I can't do that. Oh, that's gonna burn. Do not. Okay, once again, business corner. Our advice of the day: do not allow unhinged relatives to have administrative status on your social media pages for your businesses. Although it might explain the United Health Group thing that happened. Never mind. Is there like a chief executive's deranged cousin at United Health Group? I got an idea about emergency room coverage.
Boy, are we going to make the news here.
Woohoo! Stop your whining, injured people. Just speculation. Wild speculation. You hear this. This is jokes. We make comedy. I'm a chimp in a box. What am I supposed to do? Let's class up the joint a little bit. You got a top-notch interview right now.
Yeah, we have House Majority Leader Ryan Winkler as we're talking through this very big weekend happening at the state legislature, trying to get things wrapped up budget-wise by the special session on Monday. So we'll chat with him about some of these just, I know you've touched on these crazy Republican policy proposals they're throwing into these bills that are obviously going nowhere. So we'll highlight that and more with Winkler.
Representative Ryan Winkler with Brett Johnson right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Friday afternoon as we're going to switch gears and talk about some news over at the state legislature as lawmakers are preparing to return to the state capitol on Monday to begin a special legislative session to avoid a possible government shutdown on July 1st. So figure who better to bring on to talk about that than the House Majority Leader, Ryan Winkler. He is from the DFL party, represents District 46A, which includes Golden Valley, Plymouth, and St. Louis Park, and the West Metro area, as we're going to be talking about these ongoing budget negotiations. Representative Winkler, thanks so much for coming back on the show today.
Sure, happy to join you.
So the first question I got to ask for you has to do with these tax collections that came in for the month of May, which ended up being way above projections, in fact, by about $1.8 billion, which is a big chunk of change, which could certainly impact the budget. And my question for you is that does this extra money that we weren't quite expecting impact anything in terms of the negotiations?
It doesn't really change anything right now. It might change negotiations next session as we look at a supplemental budget. But for right now, it has no impact. It's just a projection and realization. Most of that money is because the income tax collections were delayed until May from April. So it's good news. There's good signs of the economy rebounding and people having more money and these collections up. But it is not really much of a factor in what we're trying to accomplish right now.
And right now, of course, you guys are trying to work through the entire $52 billion budget, which right now has been broken down into a number of working groups where the committee heads lay out their areas of dispute while leaders kind of nudge them towards potential solutions. That's at least as far as I understand kind of how these working groups are functioning right now. But in terms of these working groups, what areas are finalized and what areas are we still needing a little bit of work on?
We still, first and foremost, have to work on police reform and accountability. We need to make sure that as the people have taken to the streets and the racial justice crisis that faces Minnesota has been front and center, we have to make sure that that is translated into change, into real change at the state level. So that's first and foremost, and it's probably the hardest thing to wrap up. But we also have important issues in education, including addressing opportunity gaps in education based on race. We have to make sure that schools are funded and that kids are able to start to make up some of what they've lost during the pandemic, and critical health and human services issues like making sure that people who are working in home care or in taking care of the people who are most vulnerable in our society are getting some better compensation because the pay is so low. Of course, there's just so many issues in health and human services right now, and that's a tough negotiation. The good news is, because of Democrats in Congress and President Biden, we have a rebounding economy with more tax revenues, and we have a lot of federal funds that they sent us as part of the American Rescue Plan that allows us to make big investments that I think can really make a difference in the long run for Minnesota. So we're negotiating over good things right now, and that's a positive.
And one of the areas you were just alluding to was that K through 12 budget. Or at least on the Senate side right now, Republicans are floating this proposal, which seems like one of those things where on the surface it could be a great idea, where they're talking about how they're going to increase the school funding formula by 3% this year, which is more than what was expected. But, of course, the devil's in the details on this when you look at the fact that they are pushing for school vouchers and school choice. So seems a little disingenuous from their part that they're still including this idea of school vouchers when obviously that's got to be a non-starter on the House side, which is controlled by the DFL.
Yeah, absolutely. We're not going to privatize public education and use precious public funds to subsidize private education any more than we already do. So that's a non-starter. We have to make sure that our school funding is actually continuing over the years instead of constantly falling short the way it has for the last 20 years. We used to be exceptional in education, and in Minnesota, we're only mediocre these days. Part of that is the huge difference in achievement between kids of color and white kids. Part of it is a lack of investment at the state level. And the fact of the matter is, even with all this federal money available, we still are far from making the kind of long-term commitment to education that serves all kids that we need. And so that's going to be an ongoing struggle. But what we're really seeing is Republicans not wanting to commit to public funds for these kind of critical public investments. And their ideology, which I think is extreme, they try to cover with these concerns about vouchers and kids of color and so forth, but it really is just cover for an extreme agenda.
I think if there's any more proof that we need to fund our public schools, too, at a greater level. I mean, just look at what happened in St. Paul this week, where they basically had to shut down their entire school system because there's no air conditioning, which I know there's a lot of rural schools in that same situation. So I would certainly hope that that would show that, you know, we can't be sitting around here and trying to mess around with school vouchers when really public schools desperately need this funding.
Yeah, I mean, schools are looking at layoffs and because they can't count on the state coming through the way we used to for state aid. And that's a huge problem in rural Minnesota, which is mostly represented by Republicans. And they are not stepping up to help their own children in their own district, places where they're not going to create a new private school with a voucher. That's not going to help kids in rural communities in Minnesota. We need a strong public education system, and it shouldn't be a partisan issue, but it's becoming one.
Talking about some other policy issues that we're currently seeing from Republicans right now, I know they are very upset about the idea of the clean car emissions that are being proposed by the Walz administration, where they're basically threatening the funding of state parks. And I know they're also talking about these voter ID issues. That does have to make things tough when it comes to negotiations, when we're getting so many of these policy ideas getting put through that don't really have a ton to do with funding right now. And something that really doesn't seem like it belongs quite in the discussion right now when we're still debating things like voter ID and clean car emissions and basically kind of doing hostage taking when it comes to clean car emissions and threatening to defund state parks if they don't eliminate those clean car emissions being proposed by the Walz administration.
Well, to be fair, Democrats are proposing policy changes that we want too as part of this negotiation, and that's part of what we're trying to work out. I think what you're describing, however, is an extreme agenda. Clean cars just means that we should have lower emission vehicles in Minnesota to address climate change. That is not a radical idea. In fact, it's a broadly popular idea. The voters already rejected voter ID. That's not a popular idea. That's a radical agenda item from conservatives. So we are talking about advocating for things that the public broadly supports and helps Minnesotans, helps invest in the future. It helps make families more secure. It helps make our climate and our environment at least more stable, if not better. And so we have to do these things. We have to keep working at them. And we will take every opportunity we can as Democrats to get this agenda done because it is what the public wants.
Well, that is a good point you bring up. Yeah, when you compare the policy agenda items that are being proposed by both of the parties with, as you described, the Republicans pushing for things like photo ID or changing clean car emissions. And yeah, well, we have DFLers proposing things like environmental protections, workplace standards, paid family leave, among other things. So yeah, there certainly is a difference in terms of what's being proposed on those policy issues. And one of the other big policy issues that I know has been highlighted at the Capitol has to do with the emergency powers of Governor Tim Walz, where Republicans would still like to see those rolled back. At least in my case, I would think we're still very much in an emergency, being that people are still dying from COVID-19. But we have heard this idea being described of possibly winding down the emergency powers of Governor Tim Walz. I believe the governor has said this himself, as well as other Republicans. What do you make this of idea of having kind of phased out emergency powers for the governor?
I think as long as we're maintaining our ability to do vaccines and testing, as well as making sure that our health department and local public health agencies have the tools they need to respond to changes, I think we may be past the point soon where unilateral executive action is necessary to move fast enough to address the changing pandemic. Of course, if we end up in a situation where it comes roaring back in the fall, if the vaccines are not as effective as we would like them to be, in that scenario, the governor would have to reinstitute his emergency powers. But I do think that we are getting closer to the point where his ability to take action on his own is less critical.
Speaking with Ryan Winkler, he is the House Majority Leader for the DFL, representing District 46A, which includes portions of the West Metro area, including Golden Valley, Plymouth, and St. Louis Park. Final policy area I wanted to talk about with you when it comes to these negotiations, and you talked about it earlier, has to do, of course, with public safety and police reform, where, unfortunately, with the killing we saw in Uptown just a few days ago, that has certainly highlighted the need for more police reform, especially in light of there not being any body cams in that situation. What's your take on in terms of trying to get any more of these public safety measures put through in the state legislature? I know Republicans, for the most part, have been kind of hesitant in that area, but have things changed a little bit over the past few days and weeks?
I think it's been a question of positioning negotiations for them, not their recognition that we need to do more. They know we need to do more. They know that that's going to be absolutely essential to House Democrats and as we look at to finalizing a budget. So we will do more. The law enforcement trade groups essentially also are a big player, especially with Republicans, and they also recognize the need to make changes. So I think we will get some public safety, some police reform, some police accountability legislation done. I don't know what it is, but I do know that in some form or fashion, it will be part of a final agreement.
And final question for you here, Ryan. Governor Tim Walz said today that he's optimistic that there will not be a government shutdown on July 1st. What are your thoughts on that? Do you share that same sort of optimism, especially as we are trying to get some of these final agreements put together by Sunday, of course, before the special session begins on Monday? What are your thoughts?
I don't see a scenario where we end up in a government shutdown or a partial government shutdown. The reason this is taking so long right now is because we were guaranteed a special session in June, and that just meant people pushed the deadline back. But we are still operating according to deadlines that have shifted but are still in place. And so I don't see any scenario where we're going to have a partial government shutdown. We've had them in Minnesota. We've seen them at the federal level. Nobody wins when the brinkmanship of negotiations goes that far. In fact, everyone's position gets worse. So I don't see a scenario where it happens. We have the time to get the job done, and we intend to do so.
Well, we'll have to see, and I hope you're right about that, because we've experienced a couple of those government shutdowns over the past few years and decades, and they've certainly been ugly, so yeah, hopefully we are able to avoid those. Hey, we've been speaking with Ryan Winkler. He is the House Majority Leader, District 46A, as we've been talking through budget negotiations as the legislature will be convening a special session coming up on Monday. Representative Winkler, thanks so much for the time today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Nice talking with you.
All right, we'll take a break and turn things back over to Matt McNeil on your Friday afternoon on AM 950.
Everybody get up.
AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. I think Representative Winkler actually makes a very good point there, and that's kind of the Republican standard, because Republicans have to kind of jam all this stuff at the last second. It's not just the fact that they want to try to basically torture their own constituents to try to get, you know, ideological guarantees that don't really have anything to do with budgets. It's the fact that what they need to do, and reminder, you cannot trust these Republicans at all, that they'll become a compromise bill. And then we've had cases in the past where Republicans have gone in and that were in charge of rewriting the so-called compromise bill and added or removed things that were not, were either supposed to be or not supposed to be in there. Reminder, the light rail funding, that was, you know, Kurt Dowd, that lying sack of crap. He basically went out there and removed that funding after he promised everyone was going to be in there. When the Senate caught it, and they added it back in unanimously, I believe, that little coward boy, he gaveled the House closed and ran out the door. And then Governor Dayton spanked his caboose on that. And by the way, they're building it. I think 212, just FYI, US 212 is actually shut down this weekend because they're putting that light rail line over the highway. So how'd that go for you? I also remember, wasn't it that there was rule that was put into the bill, and that basically prevented the internet companies from selling your personal data, and someone, I don't know if it was Senator Dave Osmek, but someone, that was the name I'd heard, but someone went through and ripped that out of there and allowed that to happen, even though it had passed, I think, unanimously but one vote, which I believe was Osmek. So you can't trust these guys. And I don't know if Osmek did it at that point. That's what I'd heard. But you can't trust them, because not only are they trying to do the negotiations, but then they'll try to rewrite the bills with one person. One person will try to rewrite the bill. So you got to read this first. So that's what the Republicans are trying to do. They're trying to wait till the very last second, throw the bill out there saying, you got 5 seconds to vote now, and then hope that Governor Walz doesn't catch it. So that's the deal. So that's just, I think Winkler's right. I just think at some point they're like I said, I'll just go with the Environmental Committee. You brought in clean cars, has nothing to do with your bill. If you want to shut down the state parks when they need those state parks open, your communities, Republican communities need those parks open. You want to shut down the parks, that's on your head. And it's not the Democrats' jobs to save you guys from yourselves. 952-946-6205. Democrats should save this country from falling off the edge, though. And Todd Colet, of course, a great listener of AM 950, he lives over in Spain, can't visit our sponsors, but he wants to sponsor the station. So he does. He takes a week every month and he sponsors us. Thank you very much, Todd. We do appreciate that. 952-946-8885. 952-946-8885 is the phone number for that. If you'd like to sponsor the station as well, Todd this month wants to remind you that we have a lot of states that are basically trying to fix the 2022 and 2024 election by basically trying to disenfranchise as many voters as possible, namely Black, Latino, minority, Democrat, any place they can that they think they'll get an advantage, they're going to try to stop people from voting. And it is really nefarious, horrible things. The League of Women Voters and FairFight.com are leading the fight on this to try to stop this monstrosity. Well, and Todd Colet is wanting you to go visit their sites. I posted the links up there. I'll post them once again probably tomorrow morning. Go visit them. Sign up. Become part of the solution, not part of the problem. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. When we come on back, John Crippen from the Hennepin History Museum will join us. We'll talk about their latest exhibits and also just talk about history, because I think it's time for us, once again, as people are trying to say, no, 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 we want to go back to the white revisionist history, and that's just that. It's time for us to say no. It's time for us to actually acknowledge history. And sometimes history is good. Sometimes history is bad. A lot of times it's both. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't pay attention to it. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll talk to him when we do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We've talked a lot on this show about history. You know, of course, early this week, I had a delightful little diatribe about how we shouldn't just try to bury history. And I think it's very important, because we are at a point now, it seems like, in this country, where we're starting to understand there's a lot of people that are kind of stunned by the history that we're not taught. I mean, the Tulsa race riots were one of the issues that came up this week. We talked about Native American issues. We talked about the slavery issues. There's just a lot of things. When we had the case where the Christopher Columbus statue was torn down at the state capitol, you know, people are like, just put it back up. And people's like, do you realize who that is and what exactly he did? And on one side, you have people just saying, wow, why haven't we learned about this? I mean, as one person said to me one time, he said, we didn't learn anything. All we knew about the Trail of Tears was they said Trail of Tears. We didn't really know what it was until I was driving across the country and I came to a sign and I stopped and I read it. It's like, oh, my God. And you realize that history is ugly, and there's a lot of bad, and there's a lot of good, but there's a lot of bad. But to understand history, you have to understand both sides of it. I think that's important, and I think it's part of this discussion. I want to bring in one of the smarter historical minds I know, a friend of mine. I'll be honest, John Crippen is the executive director of the Hennepin History Museum. He is kind enough today to join us. to talk about history, because I think it's not nearly as simple as just, oh, here's what we learned, and that's just good enough. We have to kind of look at history from the right lens. And, John, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Oh, thank you, Matt. It's always fun to talk to you.
It's good to have you, my friend.
And you know this is a topic near and dear to my heart, so it's always good.
I know it is, and so I'm just – because you are far smarter on this and someone that I kind of look up to when it comes to historical knowledge and just how history is presented. Talk about, for you, what is history and how history should be looked at.
Well, listening to your intro kind of sets that up, I think. To me, history is humanity. That's why we like it. That's why it fascinates us, because it's the story of humans, and humans are just inevitably complex, and you can't put them into a box. And so as you were describing some of these new things that we were finding, it's too often when history was done poorly in the past, we tried to gloss over the messy bits, the things that didn't fit a narrative that made us feel good. But lots of times humans do things that don't make us feel good, and that's important too, and we need to understand that. So I've been saying for a long time, devoting my professional life to history means I've got to feel like there's some meaning to it, right? Mm-hmm. And the best way to have that meaning is to think about history and do history that's relevant to people, that is meaningful to their experience in their lives. And I think when you gloss over things and make too simple of a narrative, then it takes away all the color. So even though humans are messy and complicated, and often they really drive you crazy, they're also fascinating. And that's what really gets you going and grabs interest, I think.
I think it was about 20, 25 years ago when we started having discussions that really started to look a little bit more fairly at history. I think for me, the two stories that really I was kind of interested in, which really kind of started to wake me up a lot more, were one, the idea that we started describing the fact, oh, yeah, the founding fathers all had slaves and they were slave owners. And it's not this Gone with the Wind kind of slave owners revisionist history that we put out there. It was far uglier, and that should be factored into their history and the legacy. And of course, the horrible treatment of the native peoples that were on this land. And when people would say, well, why are we teaching about slaves and founding fathers? Why are we teaching about this? And I look and say, well, because it happened. You know, it's because the sun came up, went down. Yeah.
And look at your friends, look at your relatives, look at yourself. We all have contradictions. I assume one of the reasons you were pulling this up today was Annette Atkins had a great piece in the Star Tribune this morning.
Yes.
And thank you for your nice words, but Annette's way smarter than I am on this. She's devoted her life to studying history, and I thought she just put it really well. She had example after example of it's both and. It's not an either or. So Henry Sibley loved Dakota people, and he betrayed them. And to me, that's just the epitome of what we're after here. I don't think it does anybody any good to say Henry Sibley was just a horrible person, full stop. He was a fascinating, complicated, frustrating person, like so many humans are. So the more we learn about that aspect of his legacy, the more interesting, and the more we learn about his legacy and what it means to us today. Like, how did he leave the world for us today, good, bad, and ugly? Because it was all three.
It's the imperfect nature of humanity, and that brings people up. I mean, this country, we've talked a lot about Lincoln, and Lincoln is fairly admired by a lot of people. But you can't deny Native Americans have a very legitimate complaints about how they were treated under him, because they were hung in mass. It was the largest mass execution in the country's history. It was something. But by looking at that whole picture, you can say, well, the Civil War, the leading of the North to defeat the South and the Confederates and those guys, dear Lord, that was that we can't deny that was a major sacrifice and that changed the country. Unfortunately, it doesn't hurt necessarily for anyone to step back and say, yeah, but let's look at this other angle. It's just a lot of people don't like to do that.
Right. And one of the little things. This is bad history, but it's fun to fantasize about going back and talking to some of those folks. And I would love to talk to Lincoln about that whole issue of the U.S.-Dakota War and find out, was he cold and callous about this? How hard did he have to think about it? When you're president of the United States, you're making compromises all the time. And was it just because Bishop Whipple lobbied him effectively, or did he go out of his way to commute some of the sentences, but not all the sentences? I mean, just it'd be fascinating to know what was really going through his head, because to my knowledge, I don't think he wrote about it much. He had so many other things going on, but it was a momentous decision for Minnesotans.
There, when I see people that are resistant to this, you're right. It is not just as clean as I just want the white European revisionist history. There are what I see is three different paths here. One is, wow, what are you talking about? Something like the Trail of Tears. I never heard anything about this. How did the Tulsa race riot? That sounds horrible. Why did we never taught this? And there's almost an outrage at the education system. There also seems to be an element where I think it's anger, frustration that, oh my God, this happened. And whether that feels like there's an onus on certain people to acknowledge that happened. And then you do have the people that do want the revisionist history, but it's not like everything else. It's not nearly as simple as A or B. There are a lot of people that are like, why in the heck weren't we taught about this? We should have been taught about this.
Yeah. I think there are more and more people who are feeling that way. I don't know why that's an interesting question of, like, why weren't we taught this? I think for too long, and still with some people today, this is uncomfortable, and you've got to think hard about it, and it's easier not to sometimes. And you'd rather not have put in your face some unpleasant realities that are actually part of your built and lived world today. How do we all take responsibility for what came before us and how we're benefiting from what came before us? One way we do it is just kind of gloss over that stuff and say, I don't want to think about it. It's too hard. But I don't know. That's probably a simplistic answer.
I know we've talked about older history here, but I mean, obviously we have lived in pretty, historic times in Minneapolis, St. Paul the last year. And I know the Hennepin History Museum, which I, by the way, I want to encourage everyone to stop on by and visit. We'll get to some of the exhibits that are going over there in a second. But I love the fact that you guys are taking an onus to not only make sure you try to do as much documentation and working on this history as possible, but understanding the complete story of what's been going on in the city for this last year particularly, but in full context here. Because that is an interesting perspective, because you have the history unfolding in front of you, and you have that ability to get a better, a more full story.
Yeah, you do. And it's a lifelong project for folks, because these things are hidden away. There's a reason people spend their lives researching specific topics, because those things tend to just sit stored away someplace until somebody actually finds them and starts to connect dots. One example I'll give, looking ahead to an exhibit we're opening this fall, we've been doing a project with the U of M for a couple of years now on a public history of 35W. And the interstate system has already been controversial for a long time, and everybody knows about the Rondo neighborhood and the atrocity of plowing through that neighborhood in St. Paul. But until the U of M started doing this project, there wasn't nearly as much scholarship about 35W. But buried away in the highway department files, but a U of M researcher found it, was an urban planner working for the highway department in the 50s who was talking about the racial segregation, the redlining that we've talked about many times, talking about how you enforce and reinforce those boundaries. And people looked at it kind of intuitively, knew if they thought about it, but it was hard to connect those dots. But a researcher this past winter looked and found one of those magic memos that, in my mind, is one where when you do history research, you're like, wow, all right. I hate to see this because this is a bad one, but I'm glad I found it. So there's this highway department urban planner who said, you need boundaries to enforce these lines, and if there's not a natural boundary, you've got to build one. And then you look at that and look at it next to the South Minneapolis red line district, and you see they built 35W right along that red line to cement it in concrete, literally, to say, this is a line you should not cross. And when you're just driving down 35W every day, you don't think about that sort of stuff. But if somebody connects the dots for you, then you can say, oh, crap.
Yeah.
Why did they do this?
Yeah.
And then, in my opinion, now you should all, if you've got a conscience, you should say, and what can we do now about it to try to repair some of the those things that were broken by previous decisions? What can we do to start to move the needle in a different direction if we don't like what they did?
You know, and it's one of the things I do like about history is that when you have the ability to learn and get a fuller picture of what actually happened, you might be able to fix some of these problems. And I think that's kind of, for me, you know, where do we go from here? And I think that's the value of learning the history, is that now you know the truth. How do we fix it? And just kind of sit or you know, address it. And sometimes it's frustrating, like when the hangings that happened in Duluth or the Tulsa race riots. You know, there's a lot of condemnation long after the fact where, oh, this person is, you know, the people are long dead and stuff like this, and it was horrible, but now we're going to recognize it. How do we get to a point where it's not taking 100 years or 50 years, that we can kind of come back at something quicker and say, well, we've learned our lesson on this, let's fix this now? Because really, if in my opinion, when I look at societies and communities and countries that are really kind of moving ahead, they're the ones that understand their history and are not afraid to say, well, that was wrong, let's fix it. And I think that is where that's what the value of history is how you move forward with knowing what you know.
Yeah, and thanks for answering your own question, because it might have been self-serving coming from me. But I was going to say, you've got to just keep at it and not selectively forget stuff. You've got to just continue to have people like history museums and history departments do the work to uncover this stuff and continue to help society in general learn about this. And then you have to have society in general paying attention enough and saying, wait a minute, before we do this big public policy thing, let's understand how we got here and let's see if that gives us any lessons about ramifications of our decision or blind spots in our decision. I mean, this is the other thing, using the example I had, I have no evidence that these highway planners in the 1950s were terrible guys, but they certainly had biases and blind spots, and they certainly had a value system of what they were charged to do and how to do it. And if they had been armed with different information, might they have built a different highway? Hopefully. One might hope so. So
you only hope. We have to. I mean, you and I could talk for hours. Really, we could, because I
yeah,
love chatting with you, John. But I do want to get to the
Hennepin
History Museum, of course, located kind of over by the MIA there, 2300 block of 3rd Avenue South. Let's talk about it, because you guys got some exhibits over there, including the homegrown one, which I'm glad you guys are doing that. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and let's just acknowledge that there are a lot of weighty issues in history, but since history is humans, we've talked about this, sometimes you just got to celebrate the imagination and ingenuity of humans. And that's what Homegrown does. Homegrown is a fun little exhibit we put together for the summer featuring crop art mosaics. So it's art that people have created. Many of these were submitted and put in the state fair competition. And as one of our staff members put out on Facebook the other day, this is a great opportunity to see crop art, because you don't have crowds jostling behind you and around you. You can go into a small little gallery. It's a contained, easy to digest thing, and you can spend a little time with it and get up really close to it and go, wow, the detail that these people have done is amazing. I was looking at the exhibit with some of our new board members today, and we were looking at one of the prints pieces that's in the show, and the attention to detail is just extraordinary in this thing. For his mustache, the artist used poppy seeds. And I had no idea how many poppy seeds make up his mustache, but it
boggles my mind because there's no way I could do this kind of art. But it's really cool to see.
Homegrown, by the way, opened on June 3rd, so it's a brand new exhibit there. You also have Local Heroes, a fantastic exhibit about the medical industry. That's running through the summer, correct?
That's right. Both of them running through the summer. Homegrown will actually be done a little early to make room for the next show this fall, August 28th, I believe. And then Local Heroes will be there through September 10th, I believe.
Hennepin History Museum is 2300 block 3rd Avenue South. Stop on by, get a membership, and learn history. John Crippen, once again, is the executive director over there and a friend. John, anytime you need to come back, talk history, you know we'll take a two-hour show. We'll just do a two-hour show one time, you and I, okay?
Let's do it. Let's do it. That'd be fun.
John, thank you much. I appreciate it, my friend.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
Take care. We'll take a break. Come on back. Wrap up the show for the week. When we do return, it's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Maybe the Progressive Voice of Minnesota will spotlight John Crippen there. I got to make sure one last thing here before we get to the end of the show here. And by the way, no dancing this week. Hopefully via medic. Now, this is not just my choice, medical suggestion. Hopefully next week I'll be dancing again. Hopefully next week I'll be dancing. I do want to bring up this story. Yesterday, in an interview with the Rochester Post Bulletin, Minnesota Republican Party Chairwoman Jennifer Carnahan refused again to affirm the legitimacy of the 2020 presidential election. Asked, this is the post bulletin, asked whether the election was stolen from Trump. Carnahan declined to say one way or the other, but said concerns that people have should not be overlooked. No. Hey, Jen, Grand Canyon, let me make sure you understand something. Joe Biden won the election. You're just spouting lies. But no, seriously, actually, no, keep doing this. Keep doing this. Let me go back to the Post bulletin. This Carnahan said this: if there's ever any question or doubt, or people don't feel that they have the full transparency or enough things, what's wrong with just looking into things and answering those things? Funny story, back in 2016, every Republican said, Hillary lost, don't look, you just sore losers, eat that, ha ha ha, blank your feelings. Remember that? I remember that. Now all of a sudden they need a cuddle puppy. Anyway, Jen, here's the deal. I'm going to tell everyone out there, if you're the DFL, you need to get every single leader in the Republican Party on record saying this garbage, because their convention doesn't come up till next year. And if the entire next year, as Joe Biden is still fairly popular in this country, especially with moderate Republicans, if this entire time you have these people saying the presidential election was illegitimate to try to win over Republican voters, and then they have to spend the next 5 months frantically saying, I never said Joe Biden didn't win. They will get destroyed next year because they look like loon balls. But hey, loon balls, that is the new mascot of the Minnesota GOP, isn't it? Oh, fudge and delicious Sartell. Hey, have a good weekend. Try to stay cool. Native Roots Radio, Robert Pilot, best show on the station. That's up next. Till Monday. See ya.